So, shall we start? Today we'll be talking about the second topic in line on cybersecurity. We will be trying to address the main threats and vulnerabilities in digital infrastructures. So, once upon a time, it was July 2014, there was this teenager from Bergen, here in Norway, who he actually was trying, as he said later on to the police officials, he was trying to make the companies and the people, the staff, whatever, aware of what could happen if they could just, you know, leave, let's say, something open to the outsider threats. So he started this campaign on several companies. It was actually successful, sort of, because several big companies here in Norway, banks, telecommunication companies, etc., were affected. The most affected one was DNB. Its website was down for 1.5 hours. And so this was like a case, a recent case, from something that happened here. And this is also mentioned in the Data Secret for Leather book, so I thought I should also include it here. So this boy was just a teenager, and anyway, he was able to do this. According to the media at the time, he was probably alone, but according to the police, stuff like this shouldn't be organized and managed only from a single person. So he might have some collaboration, some help from other more experienced cyber criminals. And as I mentioned, he was just trying to make the community aware of what would happen. And then what's happening today is that there is this dark market, black market, where you could be able to have different services as well as DDoS campaigns, which are like from like unspecific up to highly targeted. And then you could buy those for just a very small amount of money, and you could find everything there, like service packages, everything, and also customer service, and also money back guarantee. So everything like this is part of what we are facing today, and that's why part of this lecture would be talking about the different threat actors that are out there, the different threats and the different vulnerabilities, because as you will see in this lecture and the materials and maybe in the future, there are different kinds of actors, different categories of threats, different categories of vulnerabilities, and is related to the people that are behind these activities. They come from different backgrounds, they have different goals, so let's start with some definitions. So according to the ISO standard 27002, which was specifically related to information security management, a threat is nothing less than a potential cause of an unwanted event or incident, that may occur to an asset or to an organization. So we have the words incident and asset. An incident, then, is a single or a series of unwanted or unexpected events that have a significant probability of compromising business operations and threatening information security. An event is an identified occurrence of a system which could be indicating a possible breach of policy or failure of control. Or it might also be an unknown but still relevant situation to the organization it affects. And in the end, an asset is everything that has a value to the organization. So at least some of these words here are very relevant to know and very relevant to be understood. And then we go forward. We talk about vulnerability. According, again, to the ISO standard, to the ISO publication, vulnerability is a weakness of the system through which a threat, which we already defined, can potentially harm an asset which belongs to the organization. And then, if we are just to distinguish between the three of them, or just like trying to make a connection between them, we can start with an asset, which is like everything that the organization or even us are trying to protect, because we also might have valuable things that we need to protect. And then there is the threat, which is like what are we trying to protect against. So we're trying to stay as much away from any threats as possible. We will talk about the threats again. And then there is the vulnerability, which is a weakness or a gap into the whole procedures or the whole system that we are trying to protect. So yeah. Then we should also understand that threats are always present. So we always talk about, let's say, a danger from what's called major forces or force majeure. It's like natural disasters or stuff like that. We are always, potentially facing them, but they are not always happening, right? So a threat is always existing, but it's not real as long as, at least in information security now, it can be converted to a possible to real attack. So yeah. And then there's another story. So once upon a time, when there were these long and devastating wars in the Chinese domain, there also was this Chinese general called Sun Tzu. I think you might have heard of him, who in the 5th or 6th century before Christ, he made this military document called The Art of War, where he tried to emphasize the real importance about knowing yourself and knowing the threats that you are facing. And this was mostly dedicated to the soldiers, to the military officials and so on at the time. Actually, let's go fast forward a few centuries, and today, if you would be able to look at the different books about risk or information security or cybersecurity or whatever, you would be able to see that this general from that period is one of the most highly cited people, and also his material, Art of War, is also very much cited because it's still relevant today. So it's still relevant today to understand how to know yourself, especially when you're trying to protect in your organization information. So you have to be familiar with all the information that's there and all the systems that try to store it, to process it, to transfer, and so whatever. And then also you should be able to know the threats that you face. Sorry. As long as you, as part of the organization, should be able to transfer the knowledge that you have and the expertise that you have to the others, especially to the high management, because they should be able to understand what's going on and what might be possible in the near or in the long-term future, so that they can make a proper decision-making. So let's start from the threat actors or the attackers. What are some of the typical attackers that might threaten us or our most important things and so on? This is very important because actually there is this other recent case which I just found out a few hours ago. This case is about a company here in Jövik, the Hage Selskapet, the gardening company in Jövik, where actually the story was like this. Monday morning, 2 days ago, at 9 o'clock, and there's also a link for this. So it was published in Upland Arbeiden. In Monday morning, there was this lady, which was like the finance administrator, or in English it was the treasurer, but I'm not sure it may apply to this sort of company. She got an email from her boss, and it was exactly the email of her boss, the email account of her boss, sending an email to her account, and it was saying in Norwegian. You can see here part of the conversation. So it was saying that, hey, I need to borrow some of the money, so please transfer this money to this account. Okay? Now, she got a bit surprised, but then she said, okay, so I will. So, and then the conversation continued, again with the same email account, and it seemed that actually she was even more surprised. And then she remembered that the boss actually, in that day and also in the weekend, was in a hütte, okay, in a cabin. So there shouldn't be any internet connection there, right? There shouldn't be any work-related activity, anything. So what was that? And then she tried to call him or her, Inge, and then she found out that the email wasn't sent from the boss. So it was, now it was even more surprising, and now it was dangerous. But at least she was, they were happy to understand this before everything was real. So they were happy to get that this sum of money wasn't asked from the boss, it was asked from someone else. And then it turned out that this someone else had an email account, had a name and a surname and a residence, an address. And it turned out that he was actually the name and the and his details were related to a location in Bonn, in Germany. And this is where the police have gone so far, so you can find everything in this link. And this was like one of the recent local news that I was able to find, which is like, it's like normal these days, because you can't find stuff like this. But also, it's very near to us. And then another thing. Well, you might wonder that, okay, this happens to some companies, to some people, but it also happens to this kind of people. It also happens to the CEO of Twitter. This was some news about a month ago, where Jack Dorsey's account was hacked. So this is the CEO of Twitter, and his Twitter account was hacked. And so this looks like very surprising, but also it is simple at the same time. Because whatever the attacker needed to do was to perform this so-called SIM swap. I'm not sure if you can read it. SIM swap attack, which is like one of the most recent types of attacks that are occurring lately. We will talk about this in the end of the lecture, more details. And just a sentence. So SIM swap is involving your mobile number. So if the attacker can get information about your contacts, your mobile number, then he can redirect all the services that come to your mobile number in his mobile number, and then he can access everything, right? So yeah. So what are these attackers? These might be individuals or groups of people who are attempting to exploit any vulnerability that's out there, that's being disclosed or not, it depends. And that could be either for personal or financial gain. So it could be just to, you know, to have more money in your account, but it also could be to make yourself famous, right? To do something like increase your level of self-confidence. So they should be interested in anything of value, so in any kind of asset, and that's how they start with all these things. So in more details, if we're talking about different types of attackers, then we should start talking about the so-called amateurs. The amateurs are likely the ones that have zero or at least a low level of skills. So they might try to start from something, anything, but also they are trying to use whatever in the market, right? In the dark market, what are the existing tools, possibly the free ones, but also something, you know, a bit cheap and so on. And these are also called script kiddies, like the ones that are at a very low level of programming. One case was, for example, the teenager from Bergen. Another case is the Uber case from a few years ago. This was like, when he was caught, it was understood that he was a 20-year-old boy who was living with his mom and his smaller sister. And he was just... And when the police asked him, he was located in New York or something. When the police asked him, he said that, you know, I just wanted to pay the bills. So I didn't know. I just wanted to find a way how to help my mom and so on. But this is not always the case, right? And you have the link there for this. You have the thing about what has Uber paid because of this breach they had. And then we also have the hackers. So now we are in another level. The hackers are typically with medium to high level of skills. They are trying to break into the computers or the networks in order to gain access. And then we should also try to classify them into three main categories. I'm sure you heard about this. There are the white hats, the black hats, and the gray hats. We talk about white hats hackers whenever we aim at different people who are trying to gain access into a system, but just for awareness. So it's like they are trying to help the organization where they are accessing, the institution, the agency, whatever. So they are trying to infiltrate into their systems, and then they report everything to the owner. So it's like they are, they have good intentions. And they also usually take permission to do that, and then everything is reported, as I mentioned. And then we have the black hats, which is the complete extreme, the other extreme. We have the black hat hackers. Whenever there are these guys who like try to gain access into a system, they don't report anything unless it's like a few months later and it's like to declare their a statement or something, or to get more financial funds about it and so on. And so they are trying to use any vulnerability that's out there, and they are trying to do that for illegal, personal, financial, or just political gain. Because I already mentioned that it might be for just a statement. So it's like, this is also the case of that Twitter CEO. And then the gray hats are somewhere in the middle. So it's like some of them are trying to gain access to a system, to infiltrate, to gain some personal information. And then a part of them are reporting this to the authorities, are reporting this to the owners, to the organizations. But then there are others who are not reporting it and who are using it for their own personal benefit. So these are in the middle, and that's why they're called gray hats. They might also try, some of them might also try to publish everything they know online. So it's like they publish the vulnerability, what they did, and what, and then everyone else can just be aware of it and can maybe take it forward, or maybe there might be some security guy who can just take some measures about that. Yeah. And then we have the organized hackers. So then we have like the highest level of the attackers. So we have the groups. We have the cyber criminals. We have the groups of the professional criminals who are like focused on having control, having power and more wealth. And they are like the top. Or actually, we are not yet at the top, actually. So they are like highly sophisticated and organized, and they offer the so-called cybercrime as a service. So they offer anything that can be available in the dark market for different amounts of money. And then we have the hacktivists, or the ideological hackers, which are like another type of attackers, which now are just trying to make these attacks, to make them real, for a political purpose, right? To make the others aware, to make the general public aware of something, to make a statement, and to create this sort of activity. And then there are also the state-sponsored attackers. We have been hearing about them even more in the last few years. So we have the so-called groups of individuals who are professional attackers. They are trying to gather intelligence and also maybe trying to do sabotage. But this is always in behalf of a government. So it's like they are part of the any governmental agency who's trying to harm other governments, other agencies, other institutions, usually outside, of course, their own territory. So they are responsible for espionage, sabotage. They are usually highly trained and well-funded. And their attacks are always focused on specific goals which are beneficial to their government. And then we also have the terrorists, or the cyber-terrorists, which are like trying to attack systems in order to conduct terrorist activities via networks or different internet pathways. So this is like the general picture of all the threat actors that are out there, the different types of attackers. And if you would like a visual representation of this, I have this image where you can see in the left side four different kinds of attackers, and on the right side four different levels of defense agents. These are agents. So you have the script kiddies, the ideological attackers, the cyber criminals, and the state sponsored. You can see also from their size, relevance of their attacks and actions. And on the right side, you have the central institution, like police. You have the big corporates. You have the small and medium enterprises. And then you have the individuals. And what would you think the result of any kind of simulation that would use these agents be? Well, I asked my son about that, and he said, I want the police to win, but actually this was not real. So most of the results show that the police did not win, but they were able to deter some of the attacks. And then I have this other image, which shows how can these attackers try to gain access into critical infrastructure, right? So you have the terminals and you have the stations, base stations, and both of these actually are part of the world that's part of the interface used in NetLogo, which is a simulation tool. And both of these are part of several versions of the CyberRain, which is what I've been working on in the last year when I was researching here in NTNU Yobe. And I think we might make use of some of them in the labs, and you might be able to understand how this cyber environment works and what are some things behind that also might affect both sides in this continuous war. So yeah. This, the right one, was used in the official opening of the Norwegian cyber range, and we wanted to make sure the Prime Minister, Mrs. Solberg, was able to understand that if there was an attack over critical infrastructure, it might be too late even to start your defense after this attack started. So everything must be done to prevent possible attacks, but not to recover from them. It might be too late to do that. And those agents on the right represented Nødnett, which is like one of the main providers of telecommunication here in Norway. So yeah, and what are the types of threats? There is this table, which I took from the Principles of Information Security. So these are like the main categories of threats that might affect a certain organization, its objective, its activities, and so on. We're talking about compromises to intellectual property, deviations in quality of service, espionage or trespass, forces of nature, human error or failure, information extortion, sabotage, software attacks, technical hardware failures, technical software failures, technological obsolescence, which is like when you are not updating, when you are using old systems, and theft. Yeah. And when we're talking about threats, we should understand that each organization, in spite of this table, should just try to prioritize the threats. And we will talk about this again in another lecture more in detail. Because what? You have 12 categories of threats. And in those 12 categories of threats, you might have another hundreds of threats, different threats within those categories. So would you be able to invest your time and your money in trying to protect your organization from each threat? No. Would any of those threats be relevant for your organization? Probably not, and also hopefully not. But, and so that's why you need to prioritize the threats, and you need to do that based on the particular security situation where the organization is at a certain moment. So it's like based on the context. You're located somewhere where there have been no earthquakes in the last few millennials. Should you make something about it? Should you do something about the earthquake? You're located somewhere where there's no internet. Right? Also, its organizational strategy regarding risk, and we'll talk about these in about a few weeks, and also the exposure level, that's also related to risk. So, when we talk about threats, we should state from the beginning that the attacks can either originate from within an organization or outside the organization. And when we talk about within the organization, we are talking about internal threats, or you might also have heard about insider threat, which is only part of it. Okay? Internal threats can be anything which is caused accidentally or intentionally, which is like part of this insider threat, from an internal user. That could be able to mishandle confidential data that are within the organization, and then this could enable people to threaten the operations of servers or network devices. Also, they could be able to facilitate the attacks by just making use of this infected USB media, which is also one of the typical cases of attacks, or at least starting points of attacks today. And then there might be the malware, which could be transmitted via email or malicious websites. So, if we distinguish between internal and external threats, we should be sure that internal threats are the most dangerous ones. Because if we can have access into an internal account, then we can have direct access into internal facilities or devices. So it's like you have the card now, right? That you can access the rooms here, the printers, computers, whatever, right? If someone else that's outside Antenium can have your card, if you would borrow this card to one of your friends, and then he would borrow the card to another one of his friends, and so on and so on, what would happen? There might be some danger, right? So that's how you can be affected from this internal threat. And then you might also have access to the knowledge of the corporate network, to its resources and its confidential data. And also you might have access to the different level of user or administrative privileges, which is like the highest risk there is, because you would then maybe try to make more harm to the organization. And then the external threats, they usually increase as long as you start connecting your devices to the internet or to the other room or to the other buildings or locations. So if we're talking about connections, it seems that there are 4.5 billion attackers worldwide. And why is that? Because there are 4.5 billion internet users worldwide, right? And that's from the Internet World Stats, June 2019. So it's roughly 60% of the whole world population, which today it might be even more connected, which is connected online. And any of those could be a potential attacker to yourself or to the organization. And then we all know that the world population is increasing. It doesn't matter if it's a slow pace or if it's a fast pace, it's increasing. We all know that the internet penetration rate is increasing at even higher rates. So we might have more attackers tomorrow. And then another thing to mention is that all the organizations today, even that gardening company out there, they should have, I guess, a Facebook account or a Twitter or something else, a website, right? So all the organizations out there are trying to make themselves present online. So it's like they are trying to make themselves present, and then on the other side, they are also highly reachable. So you can talk to them, you can send emails or everything to them, and then someone might click something, and that's when it all starts. So, vulnerabilities. When we talk about vulnerabilities, there are two main categories, which are like hardware and software vulnerabilities. In hardware vulnerabilities, there are some few cases, but on the other side, if we are able to exploit a hardware vulnerability, then we are able to make more damage than on the software vulnerabilities. Because the hardware vulnerabilities are very highly specific, are very highly targeted. So, for example, it might be a chip that has some bugs. For example, some years ago, there was this Intel 2 Pentium chip, which had this floating point division bug. Whenever you try to divide a number by another number, but this was just a specific case, then the system would crash. It was not able to perform that calculation. Maybe the number, the result was too long or something. And so the system would have these errors and so on. And what happened was that actually there were some researchers at the time who tried to make this thing, to announce it to Intel staff. And the marketing guys and the other sales guys at Intel, they said that, you know, this is just something that might happen to any chips, right? So this is just something that might happen to some users, but not all of them. But then this got published in a paper. And so there were many users that knew about it. Many users who tested it. Of course, the system failed. So this became a huge problem at the time. And that's when then the Intel guys, the same guys that said, you know, it's okay. Then they said, well, now there are some costs, but still, whenever we are trying to release chips, we know that there might be some bugs, and we keep on improving them at time after time. So even then, they just didn't understand what was the essence of the problem, so they just kept doing the same with other chips and so on. And then there might be these RAM memory components who usually are installed close to one another, right? Because we are now talking about very small-sized components of a memory. And whenever they are installed close enough to one another, there might be some electromagnetic issues, but also something else. And this might be somehow avoided, but also some other times exploited from the typical attacker, who might try to change the information, change the data, have access to several parts of the memory components, and then try to make use of them. On the other hand, when we're talking about software, these are the most typical vulnerabilities. There are always bugs in the software that we are using. And then these are always like typical errors in the operating system or in the other applications whatsoever. And usually the main advice from this is to just keep updating your systems, your software, and then also try to back up the files and so on. So what are some of the categories of the software vulnerabilities? We're talking about buffer overflow, which is like when the user is trying to write data that goes beyond what are the limits of the hardware or the allocated memory to the application. And of course, that might lead to system crash, but also it might lead to compromising of the data. Because whenever you try to overwrite the existing data, then you might change whatever, and then you might also make use of it. You might even provide privilege escalation. We will get back to that. Then there's also the so-called non-validated input, when you are trying to deliver some data to an application, these data are not maybe properly formatted, or there might be something else wrong with them, so they are not correctly processed from the application. They cannot be processed well enough from it, so there's this potential crash or something else, which also might be used from the attacker. There's also the race condition event. In the race condition event, there are some small activities or processes that are like trying to follow a certain order of events, right? For example, when you print something, or when you compare values or something else. So whenever there's an output depending on the other preceding outputs, which should serve as input to him, there's this race condition issue. And then I think you have heard about the meltdown case, which was a vulnerability that was long announced and promoted last year. It was just something that might happen. So it was something potential, a potential vulnerability that might be exploited. But you have also the link there. Until now, there's no real case of it being exploited. So it was just something that the researchers found, and they wanted to make it disclosed to anyone out there so that anyone could take some measures about it. And there were companies, these big companies, taking measures about it, and I think now it's okay. And then there's this weakness in security practices, which is like typical. And this is like when the company doesn't invest in some popular, well-known and secure software, but it tries to develop its own algorithm, its own procedures to secure the information and the system it has. In this case, there might be some bugs, some things that are not good enough implemented, so there might be a problem. And then there's also the access control problem, where this is like trying to control who does what, and then this is also a typical security vulnerability when it comes to software, because if someone has an unauthorized login to a certain system, then this might be the starting point for more damage to the organization. So yeah, we might have a break now and go on with the next slide later. Thank you. So yeah, we'll start with the second hour. And whenever we have these hardware or software, especially software vulnerabilities, the typical advice is to have an increased level of physical security, which is like trying to physically protect the systems, whatever, and also a certain level of malware protection should be sufficient. So now we should talk about malware. Malware, Elias. Was it a malware also? So malware are specifically designed software, malicious software, to perform malicious or unwanted actions. They might be used for different kinds of activities, stealing data, bypassing access controls, also causing harm or compromise a system. And so when we talk about malware, we should also try to categorize them. And how do we categorize them? One way to do that would be to split them in terms of the time when they are being used. And in terms of the time, it's related to the question if they are used before the attack is real or after the attack, right? I mean, or after the attack starts. So in this case, we should classify them by propagation means, so how they do spread in different systems or computers or whatever, and then by the actions they do. So once they are spread and the user may activate them or they may be activated by themselves, we will see the different types, then what do they do further? Do they corrupt the system? Do they steal service from the system, which is like bots? Do they steal information? Or are they just trying to hide themselves from the system until something happens? And then there's also the so-called blended attack, where there might be some malware who might do both. They might be used for infiltrating into a system and then to do certain action ahead of it. We'll start with the propagation malware, which are also the most common used ones because they have been developed since the beginning, I mean since before these other typical attacks started. So the first one, virus. I think you have all heard about it. It's a malicious code attached to any other executable files or programs. It usually requires being activated from the end user, and then it can activate at a specific time. So it might not be at the same time when it was downloaded or open, accessed, but it also can have an after effect, let's say. It might be spread via removable media, like USB media. It might be downloaded from the internet or from an email as an email attachment and so on. And actually, the email attachments are some of the most usual virus attacks happen. So one of them is this one. You might have heard of it. Probably you have not, because it was released in 2000. It was called I Love You because this was like the main header, you see, if you might, I'm not sure. So it was like an email sent to different accounts around the world. The subject of the email was I Love You, and it was associated with an attachment, which actually masked as a postcard, which should be like funny to read, you know, interesting. But then it was just a script It was just a Visual Basic script, which whenever the user downloaded and opened it, of course it was nothing happy about, there was nothing good about it, there was nothing, you know, interesting about it. It was just a script who, whenever the user opened it, then it was able to infect the whole system to overwrite any file types with its copies, so you would find any files with this the name, the same script and so on, everything would be affected. And then further on, a file would be executed which would try to steal the passwords from your system and send them back to the sender, which was this guy called Onel de Guzman in the 2000s. He was originally from the Philippines. And at the time, I mean, not right at the time, but sometimes after, he was actually caught. But the funny thing was that he couldn't be convicted properly, because at the time, the Philippines didn't know that there could be such attacks. So they hadn't any legislation in place regarding these types of attacks. And this was actually asked, and everything was prepared and asked from the, I think from the US government, because they were mostly interested to capture this guy. And the damage, you can see 10% of all connected computers at the time, $15 billion. And there was also a peak day where there were 45 million people affected, which had been sent this email. And they were at the time, surprised about this. They tried to open this postcard, and then everything else happened. This is about the viruses. And then we have the worms. Worm is another malicious code, which in this case is self-replicable. So it's he can replicate and he can propagate further into other systems and networks. And that's one of his main features. They are usually known to slow down networks, and they are also responsible for some of the most devastating attacks in the history. I will also try to share with you later on some files, some stuff about these attacks. And one of the most well-known worms was this one, called the Morris worm. If you didn't know about I Love You, you probably shouldn't have known also about this, because this was from November 1988, 30 years ago. This was when I was a kid, so I didn't even know that at the time anyway. This was actually also specific, and I chose it to discuss it with you because Robert Morris Jr. was at the time when this started, he was a postdoc. He was a researcher at a U.S. university. He was a researcher at Cornell University. But what he did was that he tried to create this self-propagating program just as an experiment, as the script kiddies are trying to, to experiment and to see what they can do, what they are able to do. And then this guy thought, why shouldn't I create something and then see how it propagates and then just, make some research about it and so on. But then everything got out of control. So this worm actually was propagating and multiplicating itself at a faster rate than it was expected. And it got very many networks and computers involved and affected. Most of the networks were jammed because it slowed down the activities. And this included military, academic institutions, and commercial entities. At the time, internet was not yet well spread over, worldwide, but anyway, this was able to inflict many, many damages. And the estimated cost was about $200 per US dollars per site. The funny, the other funny thing about him was that he was a postgraduate at Cornell University in the US. He started and did this, he created this program and delivered it using MIT computer, so another university. Then eventually he got caught because there were news about this, there were newspapers and media and everything. He got caught, and at the time, again, there were no strict laws about it, but even if there were, people with this kind of skills were like treated differently, which sometimes happens these days as well. So he just spent hours in community service, and then today he is an MIT professor. So yeah, you can also end up like a professor when you do such stuff. Then we have the Trojan horse. This can also be very much known to some of you. This is another type of malware, another one that's used to propagate the damage to different computers, and then you might use something else to continue the attack further. This is known for carrying out malicious operations and also is known to be disguised or hidden. That's why it's called Trojan horse, because from the history, you know that once upon a time there was the Troy legend and about a horse that was sent out from the Greek armies as a peace gift, but then it turned out it was just part of their own scheme to start and invade the whole city. In the same way, somehow, the Trojan horse is installed somewhere, and it is disguised, no one knows about it, until it starts doing all the damage. It's often found in image files, audio files, and games, and mostly in games, in video games, which have some bugs or some additional stuff that you should, that you are required to download, but then that's like it. And it also, it distinguishes itself from a worm or from a virus because it doesn't, it cannot replicate and it cannot be this much spread. So it's usually related to a single system and so on. This is a typical way how this works. This, you see here, there are these so-called disk. That's nice. So these are some storage devices that were used, like floppy disk. Yeah, sorry about this. I couldn't find the word in English. These were some devices that were used when I was a student. So this is like 15 years ago. And then that was just the time when the computers didn't have any more slots for this stuff. So that was just the time when they started using CDs and DVDs and then USB media and so on. So this was just like the end of it, at the 2000 something. So yeah. And then it may be in your computer via an email that you download something or software, usually free games, because you know what? There's no free lunch. So even if you see that something is free, there's something behind. And then the Trojan horse gets activated when the software or attachment is executed, and then it does what it does. Monitors, installs backdoors, and so on. We'll talk about this now. So what happens after the propagation? After you install, unintentionally in your computer, the virus or the worm is there, or maybe the Trojan horse. There might be malware targeting integrity. We're talking about logic bombs. We're talking about this. No, this is from Angry Birds. No, we're talking about this. This is a logic bomb. This is a malicious program that uses a trigger in order to awaken the malicious code. And the trigger might be anything. That's why it's called bomb. So it's like it just needs something to explode, right? To increase the damage. It might be a specific date. There were cases where, for example, a certain attack was always done on a Tuesday, let's say. So yeah, on Tuesdays. Or it might require a specific activation of a user account or a specific program to be executed. Then we also have the backdoors. The backdoor is nothing else than a program or code introduced by a criminal who has already compromised the system. So whenever you get access to a system, for example, you have the virus or worm, something there, then you can try and install the backdoor in order to keep yourself present in that system, in that account, right? And then you also have the rootkits. In the backdoor part, usually the backdoors are called like this because it's like a secondary way of access to a certain system, right? Even if you get caught, the back door is still there, so you might maybe try to make use of it in another way. And then the rootkit. What is a rootkit? The rootkit is, from the name, tries to modify the operating system in order to let the back doors in. So you usually use them in couple. And in another way, the back door might also be used from the system developers themselves, because there might be some shortcuts which they use in order to re-access something in the system, like try to do it from another path or from another way. And so it might be used both ways. Intentionally on both ways, but for a good reason from the developers, but also for a bad reason from the malicious users. In terms of the rootkit, as long as you're able to modify the operating system, then you're able to do anything. So you're able to access different user levels, and then you are also able to perform the so-called privilege escalation, which is like trying to gain access to a higher level of access and so on. Other types of malware trying to target integrity or availability. Bots. We talked about that. The bots are malicious software designed to automatically perform action. And that's why they are called bot, because that comes from the word robot, right? So they are asked to do something, they do it automatically. They are also used in the so-called botnets, which are like networks of thousands of bots, where there are several computers infected and they are just trying to wait until there is the command, right? Where are the botnets used? They're typically used in the DDoS, the distributed denial of service attacks. One of these was already mentioned, and the distributed denial of service attacks are a coordinated use of infected computers in order to perform the denial of service. And the denial of service is like trying to deny service to the users that are trying to access a website. And so it's like trying to interrupt all the services to the users, to the devices, and to the applications. One example for the DDoS is, one recent example is from 2012. And this was the so-called Grüm botnet. This, at the time, used to control up to 800,000 computers. 800,000 bots that might be controlled and used at the same time to perform a DDoS. And that's like responsible for 18% of the worldwide spam traffic at the time. And this was until it got caught, let's say, and then everything went down. This was in, then it got caught in July 2012. Other types of malware, targeting confidentiality. So remember, we are now trying to distinguish between the different parts of the CIA triad. Spyware. We are usually using the spyware to track and spy on the users, right? Spy software. They often include activity trackers, keystroke collection, and data capture. They often modify security features, the security settings, and they are associated with Trojan horses. Then we have the adware, which are typically trying to deliver advertisements, but sometimes they are also harmful as they are associated with spyware. And there are also the scareware, which are like scary software, and they are like trying to persuade the user to do something because something bad would happen to him, right? Scary. So they are like pop-up windows trying to tell to the user, for example, your Windows is not updated, right? It's not up to date. Try to update your system. Try to download this. Try to do this and that. They send emails trying to scare, right, the user. So they are called scareware. And then they use whatever the user does, downloads and stuff, they use to infect the system. Other malware, a typical type of malware used today is the ransomware. Have you heard about it? The ransomware is designed to hold the computer system or its data captured until there's a payment done. Ransom software. So you use it to hold something ransom, and that's typically the data, the files, somewhere in within a system. How does it do that? Usually they are programmed to encrypt all the files that are within that system where the malicious user can gain access. And there is this key that will be available to the end user, to the company, to the organization, if they are able to pay a certain amount of money. And then what happens is that the ransomware gets spread further by a downloaded file or by any software vulnerability that the malicious users can exploit. So whenever one employee might download something that looks legit, but it's not, then this is how it all starts. The most typical case of the ransomware, one of them actually, because you have had ransomware even in the last weeks or months, it's the WannaCry. The WannaCry, or the long name of it was the WannaCryptor or something, because it was used to encrypt files, and yeah, was an executable file that on the 12th of May 2017 had this impact in the global arena. There were more than... So these are like some info, but I will also detail it further in the other slides. I think there were more than 50 countries at least, maybe 100 countries affected. It's called, in this case, a ransom war because everything started out of a war. So virus, worm, Trojan horse, in this case was a worm. And it was spread via email. The final impact, 230,000 systems infected, most of them were like Windows 7 based. So it was targeted to the Windows 7 missing update. If you had another Windows at the time or another operating system, you would be okay. Then what are some of the typical cyber attacks that are used when you have all this malware going on? You might try to gain access of the passwords. How do you do that? You might use a social engineering activity. This is like trying to get as much as possible important information from someone who might be a relative, a colleague, a friend of your target, and then you can use it in order to gain access to your target's account. This is called social engineering because the attackers that are trying to do this are often using their social skills to do this, right? They are trying to socialize, to familiarize with the target's relatives and colleagues and so on. And then if you cannot do this, or if you can somehow find some information, you will also try to use the so-called brute force password attack, which is like trying to guess each one of the characters that are part of a password of the user account that you are targeting. It's like character, number, special characters, whatever. And if we talk about this, we should be able to understand that this is not easy, right? So if someone thinks that just by a brute force attack you can find a password, this is not easy. It might take up to thousands or millions of years depending on the password security level. So what do the attackers do? They use the dictionary attack. So that's how they use the social engineering. They start understanding what are the main preferences of their target, right? Pets. What are their main relatives? Names. What is his age? What are his main activities and so on? And then they have this dictionary, this list of words, this list of different data or information that might be part of the password, that might be related to the password. And that's how they end up and then try to find out the password. So these are just attempts to narrow down as much as possible the range of possible passwords from those thousands and billions of combinations to just thousands one. Or, yeah, that might be better. And so, even if you cannot do that, then there's always the solution. There's the phishing attack. What is a phishing attack? When you are trying to gain access to your target's information by just sending him an email, right? Or trying to contact him, because you don't just use the email account today, you use his Facebook account, his phone number, his WhatsApp, whatever. I will try to share something further on. So whenever you are using a phishing attack is when the malicious user tries to send an email or something else disguised as legitimate or a trusted source. And if you are trying to target specifically one organization or one single individual, for example, you have the so-called whaling attacks, which are here. What's the whaling attack? When you're trying to attack the whale. The whale is the CEO, the highest level of the management in a certain organization. So that's called whaling attack or CEO whaling attack, CEO fraud, etc. So it's like trying to attack the high-level managers in a company, and that's when you are trying to do the spear phishing, the thing that was mentioned here. Sorry about that. So this is a highly targeted, right? So spear phishing. So just that target, just that organization, and not all the names that start by E or A or whatever. Yeah. And then other attacks mentioned here, SMS phishing, smishing, which is like trying to fish to gain access to your target's account by sending him an SMS, which is disguised as legitimate, but it's not. And so that's how it's trying to work. That's also part of that SIMS web that I showed you. And that's also something that's real now in Norway, because I think they have been trying to bypass the messages that are sent to these users when they are connected to a certain communication provider like Telia or whatever. So they might actually gain access to your phone number, and that's how they can maybe send you an SMS which looks like okay, but it's not. And then you also have the farming, which is like trying to persuade the user that the website that he's accessing, it's legal or legit, like, you know, it's the one that should be, but it's not. So that's just an imitation, a copy, an impersonation of the regular website. And they are trying to deceive the users, and they are saying to them, you know, if you want to use this service, you have to log in with your Gmail account, right? And you do that. You have to log in with your Antenu account, because that has already happened. And you do that. And that's when you realize that you are not going to the Antenu-related service or to the Gmail-related service. You are just going to a fraud account, which will use your personal information to steal information or to steal money from you. So yeah. And then you have also the networks. You can use a sniffing attack when you are trying to monitor, to eavesdrop, it's in English. So it's like you are trying to spy whatever is going on in the network connections. So you can examine all the network traffic. You can target a specific protocol or service or whatever. And then you can see how it goes around the network and what happens further. This is also used somehow for a good purpose. So this is also used from the network administrator to understand how the network he manages is working. So this might be used also both sides. Spoofing. It's another network attack when you are trying to imitate a trusted relationship between two different systems. If you are able to gain access into one of the systems, then you might gain access to the other system by just trying to do this connection work, and then everything might be in your disposal. And then there's also the man-in-the-middle attack and the man-in-the-mobile attack, which is also related to the cases I mentioned before. So it's like when someone is intercepting the communications between two different systems, and then he can take the content from that communication, change it, manipulate it, use it for other more actions, and so on. This can also be done using a mobile device, and that's called man-in-the-mobile. Several cases used for this lecture. The first one, the CEO from Twitter. How was the case like? It all happened on the 30th of August, a month and a few days before. It was a Friday. And you might see that several of these attacks, at least two from the ones that I'm mentioning here, has have happened on a Friday, right? So WannaCry attack, the 12th of May was a Friday. This attack was a Friday. Why? Because then you have the weekend. So then it might be difficult for someone to get after you and so on. But then you also, it might be the other way around. Then you also might have the highest level of fame, right? Because it's a weekend, everyone is online, everyone is tweeting, whatever. So in this case, it might be just for the purpose of publicity. So yeah, there was this anonymous hacker, because actually they weren't caught, but they just spread the news about it. They got they accepted that they did it. So they just tweeted it, and there was this anonymous hacker group which took over his Twitter account, the Jack Dorsey's account. And why it was understood? Because suddenly he started tweeting some stuff like this. So he started saying Nazi Germany did nothing wrong, and this was completely not related to whatever he was doing at the time or in the past years. So he has always been trying to shut down all these accounts and so on, and then these accounts were the ones that attacked him. And so this was like it, and then this was a group who was responsible for this. They should be hacktivists, because they are trying to promote their ideas, they are trying to promote their thoughts, their political ideas and so on. And it was a SIM-12 attack, which is like similar to a smishing attack. But in this case, I'm not sure if any one of you has a Twitter account. I don't, but I was able to understand how it works. So Twitter is now enabling all the users to just tweet something by just sending an SMS, something like that. So it's like using your phone, but instead of your phone, you're using Twitter. And then what happens is that whenever you are trying to access your account, you have a message that says that you can now go on in Twitter. And in this case, they were able to call whatever one was the provider, the US provider of the mobile number, to the CEO account. And they were able to gain some information from them, of course, because that was the only way. And then they got transferred the same number to their own account and so on, and that's how it was developed further. So they were able to access it by just changing the SIM card information to the account. So yeah, the hacker either convinces or bribes the carrier employee. It's like he's saying, "Hello, I'm Jack Dorsey. I would like to change my information," and so on, and that's how it works. So we are talking today about two-factor authentication, but even that sometimes doesn't work enough, right? Yeah. Another case, Nosh Hydro. So this was another recent case that happened in Norway. This was like the thing that I talked about in the last week. So it's like 2 years ago, nothing was interesting about this kind of stuff in Norway. And in 2019, we had Norsk Hydro. And it's according to the evidence, now it's already 6 months after it. So there are more and more evidence coming in. There are also the publication, the information published from the IT department head in Hydro and so on. And it seems that everything started with a certain email, right? So there was an employee in one of the Hydro plants in Italy. I think a few weeks ago it was mentioned something about the Netherlands. But now it seems everything is related to Italy. So it gets updated. So to Italy, and he was just communicating by email with this client, customer, and at a certain moment he was just waiting some file, some attachment for me, right? And then what happened was that in December, in the 5th of December, you have the link there at the end from the Dagen Næringsliv, the newspaper, and also something from the NRK. You can find it. I think I have it in one of the labs anyway. And then, in the 5th of December, he received the email, and the email had a virus. So he had an attachment, which, again, the employee thought it was not, dangerous. It was legit, so it was okay. But actually, it was a virus. And then he downloaded it, and then it started its own way. So the impact was that there was this final lack of ability to connect to the production systems, causing several production challenges and temporary stoppage at several plants. And there were also some plants which switched to manual operation. This was confirmed from the company authorities. And later on, it seemed that this attack was executed using a system file vulnerability. They knew that something was going on there. They knew that there was some vulnerabilities in the systems that Norsk Hydro had. So they tried to make use of it as much as possible. They tried to deceive this employee, send him an email, their attachment, and then they used the file vulnerability to propagate it further. So that was now in March. There were 3 months between this, and nothing happened. Nothing interesting happened, but something happened in the background. And then the network was already compromised. It was email and so on. And the ransomware actually wanted just to disrupt the operations. So it's not that they wanted money. Even so, even that they used the ransomware and so on, it looked like they just wanted to harm the reputation of the Hydro, to make some additional costs, but not just take money from them. Sorry about this. And the ransomware was called Lokergoga. It was not the first time for this ransomware to be used. The first time ever was in January 2019. There was another company in France, an engineering consultancy company, which was called Altran, and which was affected by this Lokergoga. And the text here was the same that was used and was delivered to them. This was a text file that was the only one that could be accessible from the systems after they were affected from this ransomware. This was the same in the Norsk Hydro attack. And as I mentioned before, this is not a worm, it was a virus. So it's not like WannaCry, it's a virus. And then it was able to log off all the users, everything that was inside the code there, to encrypt most of the file types, like 19 different file types, erase some specific files that might be relevant and maybe easy to decrypt. You will not be able to boot your systems, and it seems also that this wasn't a targeted attack, but that just happened. It happened to Hydro, and they said that it might happen to many other companies, because what they did was, since they shared the information, then many other companies in Norway and worldwide were able to take measures from that. Then we have the WannaCry attack. The WannaCry attack was